Welcome to Cooking Rice, a series of interviews with people who are as deeply engaged in social transformation as they are in their own personal journeys. This is your host, Marty Janowitz. This is part two of my conversation with Jane Hester.
So at the academic side sounds fairly intellectual. The art side sounds creative. How did you approach, you know, the other element, which is important in most spiritual traditions and in Buddhism, of self-knowing? How is that brought into the school, or what was it not, at least in the early time?
No, we knew that we were going to start out with meditation. We knew that was going to be a big part of it. And, you know, experimentation is a wonderful thing. So we began the school, and everyone would come together, and we would all do meditation for 10, 15 minutes. And then we'd... Teachers and students. And then we would go to our classrooms, and at the end of the day, we would do that. And we discovered right away that the benefit of all sitting together and doing meditation, which is this kind of settling, and just, it's all right to just be here. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to think about whether our hair is good or we have the right clothes or all the things that teenagers think about. We just sit here and we're all together, and it doesn't matter which age. But that benefit somehow was watered down because they had to get up and have this energy to move off to their classrooms. So we very quickly decided we would do that morning practice in the classroom in chairs. But that worked best because then everything was very settled when we started. And at the end of the day, we would all go and be together, and that was actually really good. We discovered that really worked well because if somebody said something to you and upset you during the day, and you were carrying that luggage with you, then you were sitting on a cushion next to somebody, next to this person, and you're all just sitting there and letting everything drop away. And that's what we would, you know, we would say to them, you know, let it drop away, leave that here. And you get up and you get to go home, you know, you get to leave anything here that's happened during the day. So that's how it started. Eventually, we moved to the point of doing the sitting in the morning and in the afternoon in the classrooms, except on Fridays where we would all get together, and that was kind of a real nice little set. And today, the way it works in the upper school from grade 7 through 12 is that we have someplace along the way we added yoga. And so we have 10 minutes of yoga and 10 minutes of sitting in the morning. And then every class begins and ends with a bow. And the bows are more than just gathering and bowing, but they're gathering and just being there for a few seconds and then bowing, so that we actually have a chance to just stop and signify the beginning of something new and the end of something new, and bring that process of just being there for a moment with nothing to do, nowhere to go, except to be with your breath, to be with your mind, that mindfulness, gets repeated throughout the day.
Now it's not starting to sound anymore like a conventional school. It's starting to sound a little bit, it could be Buddhist, could be esoteric in some unknown way. But I know that a large percentage, I don't know what percentage now and over the years, has been a large percentage of your students have not been Buddhist. And how and why do people who might not have any idea, or maybe even a cautious to negative idea about being associated with something odd, how do they make sense of this? Why do they come?
I guess it works for them. I think that's the bottom line. And you're right. We started out the first year of the school, we had 27 students, and only two were not from the Buddhist community. The students themselves, they're very willing to do the practices. They're very excited about the practices, actually. I mean, they wouldn't tell you that. But when, like Robin Trail is the director now, and when Robin does like an hour-long workshop with them on leadership, and he talks about mindfulness and he talks about developing awareness, they listen and they hear it and they have questions and they engage it completely. Sometimes it's kind of mind-boggling, you know, because 1 minute they're fidgeting and they're going, oh, I'd rather be texting. And then if you engage the subject, they're right there. And the parents too, you know. I mean, that's part of the thing. That's the first thing we tell them, that we do these practices and that the students are expected to do them every day. And so, I mean, that's a huge, hugely who we are. The other thing I think that helps bring that sense of mindfulness and awareness to them is the fact that 70% of our staff in the school are Buddhist practitioners. And so they bring that quality that they're always working with their minds. That's their practice. They bring that with them. You know, they set it out.
Has your staff largely been able to deliver that kind of message and environment without it being Buddhist? Or how do you bridge the having it be connected to those principles, but non-secular?
Well, because the teachers, what they bring to it is the way they think about things, the way they express things. It's not like they're talking about Buddhism all the time, but they are talking about, well, look at your own mind. You know, what are you thinking when you say that to me? You know, like I will say, seniors this time of year, you know, they've got senioritis. They just want to be partying all the time. And so I will turn to them and I will say, why are you talking in the middle of the class? I'll say, why are you talking? And the correct answer is, because I'm rude. And so I'll say, why are you talking? And they will create their own answer around that rudeness. Well, because I was thinking about myself. Or I was thinking about playing, or, you know. So just saying, why are you talking? Look at your mind. Why are you talking? Just asking a question like that is extremely Buddhist. But it's not Buddhist. It's just saying, you can be aware of why you're doing this right now. So I think there's that. We teach, like in the history courses in grade 7, 8, 9, all religious groups are touched upon. The origin of all the religions are touched upon. In grade 11, 12, they can take religious studies, which again goes through all the religions, the five major religious groups and other groups, and talks about where they came from, what their dogma, what their beliefs are, trying to get them to understand and have tolerance for all the different beliefs in the world. So all of that is introduced. Now, at the same time, we try sometimes to make sure that we're not doing anything too Buddhistic, not trying to use too much language. And I have said to classes, I can remember back in 2000, I said to a class, well, we're not really a Buddhist school. If we were a Buddhist school, we'd all be wearing monks' robes and we'd have shaved heads, and I'd get to carry a whip. And they said, oh, no, you can't say that. This is a Buddhist school. I said, well, why do you say this is a Buddhist school? Well, because we know it is. And an 11th grade student about a month ago said, why aren't there any Buddha statues in this school? I said, well, but why would there be Buddha statues in this school? Well, because there should be. Sit down there on the gym floor where that flower is. We should paint a Buddha right in the middle of that. Now, this kid is not from a Buddhist family. He's been in the school for 2 years and resistant to all kinds of things, just your typical teenager. And yet he's saying, why aren't there statues of Buddhas in this school? Let's put one here and here and here, you know. I don't know where it comes from, really. It just comes.
Well, that's an interesting outcome. I'm using the word outcome advisedly because it seems today that education is all about outcomes. How do you define outcomes, and how many of them match up against what the Board of Education looks at as outcomes?
Well, since we became a high school, before we went to that, we did a lot of research on that. And to be a high school and to give a diploma, we give the Nova Scotia Provincial Diploma, and we have to fulfill the requirements for the Department of Education to do that. Really, you know, educators know how to do this. So if you're an educator, you've been taught, you know how to do this. Not a big deal. And for the most part, we feel like we do more because we have more of a holistic, and I know that that's kind of a catchphrase, but we do have more of a holistic view of how we do things. And we deal with more aspects of the students. So we don't feel like we have any trouble fulfilling the outcomes of, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, or scientific outcomes for the classes. But, you know, we look at it and we say, what do we want our product to be? You know, critical thinking is huge. Understanding the issues of the world today and tolerance for the people in the world today. And a knowledge of sustainability and what that means personally as a human being and what that means as a society and as a world. Knowing that they have options for their lives and that they choose to live in a society and they choose to make the society the way it is. Those kinds of things are outcomes that we value beyond learning the subject matter. We were talking about the difference of, you know, just delivering the product, delivering the material. One of the things that I would say to that is that delivering the information and having the student learn the information, I call the scenic southern route. Okay? And I got that from an old teacher that I had. The scenic southern route is, if you don't want to be a human being learning, if you just want to get through the course and get the grade and get out of here, you want the scenic southern route. They give you the book, you read the story, you answer the questions at the end, you hand them in, you get graded. Nobody asks you what you thought. You don't have to have a thought. You just have to be able to find the information. But as human beings who have curiosity and an inquisitive mind and a sense of connection to other human beings and an understanding of growth and potential, you want to be able to dialogue. You want to find out what that person thinks. You want to be able to share what you think, articulate it. And if during this ripe and potential period of a young person's life, they don't learn how to do that, who's going to teach them? Where and when are they going to learn? And so that's the difference between the scenic southern route and kind of the harder-edged learning more kind of route. So I don't know where that fits.
If a student doesn't manage to gather the material to answer the questions on the exam, you can drive it into them through, you know, different means of, you know, training it, you know, and practice and tests and who knows what. But if you have a student who doesn't seem to be realizing or fulfilling these other kinds of outcomes, how do you get after that?
Well, you know, the belief in basic goodness says that they all can. there's potential there for us all to have an open heart and be able to connect with each other and connect with ourselves. So having said that, most teenagers are going through very difficult periods of their lives. I don't want to go back and be a teenager. You couldn't pay me enough to do that again. And so looking at where they're coming from, you can begin to see the best way of leading them forward. So let's say we have three students who are all 15 years of age and getting into drugs. And student A's mom and dad just split up. And student B's mother died 2 years ago. And student C is an only child, good family, mom and dad are still together, and basically give him everything he wants. And you look at them and you say, those are three very different situations. How do we deal with that? Well, the kid who's going through the divorce and, you know, doesn't know what's up or down, he needs to understand that there are people there to support him no matter what, right? He needs to know that. The kid whose mother died needs to know that everyone in the world can give him warmth. You know, he doesn't have to feel in the cold. And the one whose mom and dad are supportive and who has everything going for him, and you say, hey, why are you doing this? What do you think is so tough about your life? You got to go this way. You know, and so you have to be able to look at them and work with what's going on with them as teenagers, to work with the symptoms.
So it doesn't seem like a conventional approach to grading is really going to work that well in the setting you're describing.
No, it does. It works fine. We do have a very conventional approach to grading. I think that we probably bend over backwards more with students who have issues than a lot of times we, you know, would like to. But that's because in the long run, we feel like working through their issues are more important to them. If they pass, that's great. They may never get the grades that they probably could get if they didn't have these issues to deal with. But we can help them. We can draw them through, help them get good enough grades to pass sometimes. Sometimes not so much. Sometimes, you know, they just, you know, there are other ways of doing it. I, as a personal educator, forever have not believed in keeping a child in school if they don't want to be there. I think that a teenager who doesn't want to be in school shouldn't be made to be there. They should be taken out, and they should have to get a job and work for a while. And then when they're ready, they'll come back to school if that's what they want to do. And, you know, if that's not what they want to do, then they'll find their way some other way. I don't think, you know, education's the only way. You know, you have to have two things. You have to be offering something that makes a student want to be there, but they have to be wanting something that makes them want to be there too. You know, they can't come in and expect you to make everything work for them. They got to bring something to it. I don't know if that's answering your question.
No, that's very interesting. Have you ever failed a student for lack of awareness?
For lack of awareness? Yeah. I cut dead wood for lack of awareness, for sure.
That would be an interesting thing to figure out how to evaluate.
Well, it's just, you know, when you're working with someone and you're giving your 150%, and if they're given their 30%, you kind of go, okay, come on, we'll get a little more. And the minute they don't give you their percent, you say, hold on, you've got to understand something. And how could we make you understand this? And sometimes there's only one way to make them understand it. And that's to say, this is not the right place for you.
On the other side of the equation, I presume you've got to have had some heartwarming examples of students who you say, wow, look what they're doing, look who they are. Share a couple of notable successes.
Oh, notable successes. Well, they're all successes. They're all wonderful when they come out. You know, I guess a notable success would be when a student that's been there for a long time and has an issue with never being able to say I'm sorry about anything, never being able to take responsibility for anything they've done wrong. When you finally connect them, one young man was, I guess some seventh grade boys had gotten a hold of condoms and they were filling them with water and, you know, making water bombs. So this older student had gotten one from them and dropped a water bomb out the school window. And I said, you can't do that, you know. And again, this is a student who could never really say, yeah, I did something wrong. And was, no, no, you know. And I said, hey, wait a minute. You know you can't do that. You just got caught. Just admit it and say, yeah, you caught me. And we'll go on with it. And it clicked. And from then on, that problem was gone in his life. You know, and that's success. When a parent, when a person comes to me, the end of the first year, someone in the Buddhist community came to me and said about one student, I just had a discussion with that young man. He stood and talked to me for 15 minutes. How did you teach him to do that? We didn't teach him to do that. We just gave him an opportunity to bring it out of himself, you know.
Do you think that the results are always immediate, or have you seen any students who you feel, boy, there's something bubbling there, and then it's 5 or 10 or 15 years later now that you've had graduates for 14 years, you said?
Yeah. Marguerite Drescher, whose graduate is, she's actually working her way into stepping in and taking over all of our women's circles, which is what she wants to do. And Rachel Vogler, who is a doctor, has, since she was at the school, been very much influenced by this desire to always be working with young women and educating them about their bodies, you know. Those kinds of things are, you know.
You just mentioned women's circles. I don't know anything about that. Tell me a little bit about what that's all about, and do you have men's circles?
Yes, we do. So the first year of the school, in grades 7 and 8, there were 8 students, and they were all girls. And so when I did health with them, it was all girls, and we could talk about all these girl subjects. And that was wonderful. And the next year, we had this influx of boys into the classroom. So when we had health class, it wasn't the same. And very quickly, I realized that there was a lot missing from the girls being able to just, you know, talk about their own stuff. And so we started women's circles. And of course, if you have all the females out of the classroom, then all the males have to be someplace. So there were men's circles. And I must say, in the early years, I'm not sure what happened there. I'm not a man, which is always my go-to. I'm not a man. I don't know what goes on in men's circles. And I won't plan them, and I won't do anything about them. So the women's circles, we started out at the beginning that when the girls had their Reach Men Arch, they could come into the women's circle. Although one year we had one girl in grade 7, only girl who wasn't in the women's circle, and we didn't want her left out, so we started bringing her in. So now it's all grade 7 through 12. And we do things like, well, we have babies come in, and we talk about having babies, and we get to play with them, and the women who've had them talk about having them. We talk about breast health, and usually have someone from the breast health clinic come in, and we talk about female hygiene products, and we talk about anything that relates to women. We usually have once a year when we do facials together. In fact, we had one lovely women's circle where we all put the mud on our faces, and then we went out and opened up the engine of a car and were told what the parts of the engine were. So we were all standing outside with green faces looking at the engine of a car. And whenever one of the girls in the school reaches her menarche, we celebrate with cheesecake. And so everybody's really happy for her. And then she's kind of more happy than she would have been otherwise. Now, the men's circle.
I don't know if I even want to go to the men's circle.
Well, I want to say a couple things. You might not want this, but the men's circle, they decided that the boys' grades 7 through 9, or even 7, 8, 9, 10 sometimes, and 11, 12, but they're in for different things. And the men's circle had a hard time getting off the ground until Noel McClellan came on our staff. And Noel created a curriculum for them.
He's a young man.
Yeah, he's a young man. He's been there for, I don't know now, 7 years maybe. It's been very successful. It's been wonderful. For example, one day he came to school and he was all scruffy and his shirt was wrinkled. And I'm going, oh, he must have, something must be going on with Noel. Why does he look like that? There was a men's circle he had with the grade 7, 8 boys. He taught them how to iron a shirt and how to shave. And they loved it. They thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. And they have times when men come in with their babies and talk about babies. And then they have times when they do male bonding on the basketball court or out playing baseball.
You said they come in with their babies. You mean they...
They bring their babies in and talk about being dads.
Oh, so these are high school kids who already have children.
No, these are adults.
Oh, adults.
Like Noel brings in his daughter children. Adults, yeah, who come in with their babies, and the boys can think about that as part of their life, you know. I mean, basically, it's really, you're growing up. How do we show you what it is to grow up, you know? So Noel teaches them how to shave and iron their shirt. I think one of the things that people like about our school is that there is an opportunity to be genuinely yourself. And for teenagers, finding out who that is huge.
This concludes my two-part conversation with Jane Hester. Tune in next time as we engage in another conversation, Cooking Rice Together. Support for Chronicles Radio comes from our listening audience. To contribute, go to chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work. Thank you for joining us today.